Welcome to Better Cast Saul, the officially unofficial podcast for Better Call Saul on AMC. I'm Jim.
I'm Alexis.
And today we're talking about Season 5, Episode 7, titled JMM. Do you know what that stands for?
Just Make Money.
Wrong. It's Jimmy Morgan McGill.
Damn, you showed me up again.
Wrong. It's Justice Matters Most.
Wrong. It's Jackalopes.
Make money.
Damn.
Yeah, what'd you think of JMM?
I liked it. There were a couple of explosions. And I'm always up for explosions, yes. Well, one was more of an emotional explosion.
Oh, okay. Yes.
But yes. What did you think of it?
I also really, really liked it. Coming off of last episode where Kim sort of proposed a ridiculous plan here for them to get married in order to essentially cover their illegal tracks. I didn't know how I felt about that. Well, I kind of knew how I felt about it. I didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it from a viewer standpoint, but I didn't like it from a Kim standpoint. After seeing it go down this episode and them actually get married and watching that moment, I understand it a little more. Like Kim's side of it, but it still feels real dumb. Real, real dumb on her part.
Very risky on her part.
Oh, yeah. Extremely. And it doesn't get, you know, any less risky throughout this episode. Like, or I guess the amount of risk she's taking on here is impressed upon her even more throughout this episode with their weird, like, opposite day, emotional opposite day confessional pact.
Yes, which immediately turns around and bites her in the ass, the next morning, the very next morning.
Of course. Jimmy's not going to settle down at all being married. He's just going to continue to be Jimmy, and things are going to spiral out of control, and I can't wait to see it.
Naturally.
All right, let's start the recap where Kim and Jimmy are discussing their arrangement to keep each other informed, which, like I said, seems like this opposite day deal from Jimmy's side. Huell shows up and offers to do all the things that are associated with weddings, but Jimmy says, this is just a legal thing. No need for that. And they sign the paperwork, and Jimmy asks how Kim feels about the marriage. She says, it's fine. It's fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, the courthouse is burning around her. This is fine.
She's still very much like in the mode of this is a legal arrangement and I don't really feel any strong emotions, but it makes sense to do this. And that's sort of betrayed by the next scene. But let's talk about Huell's fancy jacket.
Yes, please. I love those studded lapels so much. And the pink underneath, yeah. It was perfect.
It's amazing. Huell... I'm trying to think, what's the fanciest I've ever seen Huell? This has got to be it.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. And then when he offers to swipe a ring, and like it's so good. It's so good. And Bob Odenkirk is playing this like very... there's a weird line here because like he knows that they're both kind of underworld people, right? And
mm-hmm.
He's not really like fazed when Huell offers to go swipe rings for him. But at the same time, he's just like trying to keep his cool about the emotional side of this. And I think how invested in this thing he is.
Yeah, because so he knows that Kim is not 100% invested in it. So he is trying to suppress that in himself.
Yeah, he doesn't want to like come on too strong, even though they're getting married, which is such a weird thing to say.
But I love how like sweet and just absolutely ride or die Huell is mm-hmm. in the beginning of this scene. It's adorable. It's so criminal, the things that he is offering. But then at the end of the scene, he's standing there with a fucking throwaway camera getting mm-hmm. wedding photos. Adorable.
You were totally right, by the way. They did this so that she wouldn't have to testify.
She wouldn't be forced to testify against him. Yeah.
If things broke bad for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that later on in this episode, we're going to have a bit of legal feedback to talk about that in more detail. So stay tuned for that. Exciting morsel.
I have so many complaints about the process of this. Number one, $25? Are you fucking kidding me? Mm-hmm. We had to pay $75 for our marriage license. Inflation, man. It's a bitch.
Yeah, 2004 to 2020. And
2019. Then, yes. And then they were able to get a civil ceremony the same day.
Yeah.
Like 5 minutes later.
That's not super realistic here in Cincinnati. I can tell you that much.
No, we would have had to wait 3 months if we had gone that way.
Yeah.
Terrible.
And even though, you know, he's protesting about this just being a legal thing, it's definitely not for Jimmy. And you can tell he just, it's weird because Jimmy, I don't think, wants to admit that he loves Kim to anyone other than Kim.
Yeah.
It's like he's very walled off with his emotions until they come, you know, bursting out, which we'll see later in this episode. But yeah, he doesn't want anybody to know that he's in love with the woman he's marrying, it seems.
His whole relationship with Kim, he keeps kind of on the DL. I think a lot of that might be just to protect her as well as his own emotions.
Yeah.
Because
she's not super emotional either.
No, she's not. But he is a dirtbag and she tries to protect her reputation. I think that's always been a dynamic in their relationship. She's always been the more straight-laced, legit person.
Oh, definitely.
So he's always kind of downplayed his role in the relationship, which is a little sad, but also he's kind of a dirtbag, so.
Well, I mean, he pushes around the edges, but he also, most of the time, knows when to back off, too.
Mm-hmm.
And also in the scene, they ask him for the paperwork about his two marriages before, which was something that people had been speculating for a long time about in Breaking Bad. Like, there's a line right after the I Fuck Ted episode where he tells Walt that he caught his second wife screwing his stepdad or something. And everybody was like, well, could Saul have been married twice? It doesn't really look like he was married in Better Call Saul. But here, I guess we get legal confirmation of that.
Yeah, Kim is his third wife.
Yeah.
So he's fresh off of being cheated on however many years ago. That sucks.
Second wife screwing my stepdad. Current stepdad?
We don't know how many times his mom's been married. We don't even know what stepdad really means.
Yeah. Okay. That'd be interesting. Maybe his second wife is going to come back and screw Kim's dad. That would qualify, right?
Where's the I'm looking for the tinfoil. Where do we put it?
Oh, it's in the kitchen.
Okay. That's a good place
found.
For it.
Nowhere to be found.
Also, it's aluminum, it's not tin.
It's fair. All right, Kim and Jimmy get married in the courtroom by a judge in an awkward but thankfully short ceremony. No glitter, no rice, no bubbles, no litter. I couldn't help but love those signs.
Bubbles.
Yeah, what's the big deal with bubbles?
I have many questions about marriage ceremonies just in general, but I've seen rice. I've seen glitter, I guess, if by that they mean confetti. Mm-hmm. Bubbles. Interesting.
I mean, I could see it, but it seems pretty harmless. It's soap. Like, if anything, it'd just clean up the courtroom.
No, listen, you have to rinse away soap for it to clean. Otherwise, it's just sticky. Sticky everywhere.
Once every 6 months, you get
sticky
in there with a hose.
Everywhere. Maybe that's what was on the ceiling in the courtroom.
Yeah,
lady.
That was disgusting. That was absolutely disgusting. We'll talk about that when we get there, but my God.
It felt very intentional, but also mad yucky.
I do have a question about this ceremony. Who is this other witness? Is that Huel's wife? Is that Huel's mom? Is that Huel's sister? Like, who is this?
I meant to look that up, and I do not know. It is another person.
I didn't
see
anybody mentioning it.
I didn't
and
either.
I don't think we've seen her before, but it's somebody. It's a human being. Qualifies as a witness. Halfway through this scene, when they start the ceremony, I am like 50% surprised that they both say I do by the end of this. Like at the beginning of the scene, I felt like every single moment there was the opportunity for one of them to say, you know what, this is a crazy, ridiculous thing to do. Call it off. Like Jimmy, because he's kind of dooming Kim to this crazy life that he's living.
Mm-hmm.
Probably feels a little bit of guilt about that. But also Kim, because maybe her better judgment takes over.
Yeah. At the end of the day, they are both lawyers, though. They know they can get out of marriage pretty easily.
I guess so, yeah.
So it's not like, I don't know, it might not feel the same. I didn't totally appreciate the line where he says, oh, this might not be what you imagined when you were 12. fucker, not everybody is dreaming about their wedding day when they're 12.
Huel's been dreaming about their wedding
day,
apparently.
Some people are looking for lizards in creeks and stuff. Sorry.
For a wedding? Speaking that's a little weird.
From personal experience? Yeah, I meant to tell you. Lizard I tried to get a wedding. Lizard caterer, but everybody was booked. It was just like the civil ceremony. It was the civil ceremony all over again.
Well, how long did you wait? Did you give the requisite 12-month window?
So here's what happened.
To the lizard wrangler?
I had to call, and you know how I am with phones.
Oh, yeah. You texted, and they didn't respond.
Yep, I emailed. I texted. I called. I stayed on the line for about 10 minutes on hold, and then I hung up.
That's generous. I do have to say I love the decision to have the judge make them look at each other and say I do, because this makes them like confront any personal feelings they have about this relationship right then and there. And if they were ever going to like call it off, or if they were ever going to feel something about this, now is the time. And they do feel something about it. And they both seem to very much be excited about it on like a personal, emotional level.
By the end of it, yeah. In the end, I think they bond over the same thing that they always bond over, which is laughing, one, at the world, and also, two, at someone else. Because as soon as the judge says okie dokie, Kim's like trying not to just hold it in.
Yeah, she's got no middle name. That's not that weird. The judge points it out. I feel like this judge does not do ceremonies very often, does he?
I don't know what this judge's whole thing was. I guess whenever there's not that many people in the room, he's just like, super cash.
I guess so.
Casual marriage day.
He has no prejudices about what people might want for their wedding. Might have envisioned as a 12-year-old. He just gets the job done.
Yep.
So after getting married, Kim heads back to work. Nacho calls Jimmy to tell him that Jorge de Guzman needs his services in court. Jimmy enters his plea and bail, we'll talk about that in a second. Bond is denied until the trial in 6 weeks. Okay, I had to look up bail versus bond.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why this judge says bond, and maybe there's some weird New Mexico wrinkle in the law that forces people to get bonds rather than just pay bail.
Like a BMV instead of a DMV?
Yeah, but my understanding is that bail, and I'm sure Doug could help us out on this, bail is the money that you would personally pay or your family would personally pay to the court to be released temporarily while you're awaiting trial. Bond is the loan that you get from a bail bond company to pay your bail.
Interesting.
That's how I understand it, but there could be, like I said, something in New Mexico law that either forces people to get bonds and doesn't allow them to pay it personally, or some other weird wrinkle.
I didn't even think of that distinction. I just kind of knew it was money, basically.
I mean, that's fair. I there was not much I could think of in the moment while I was watching this episode other than that disgusting black stain on the ceiling, which they chose to frame right next to Jimmy's head. And I don't know if that's like an intentional, you know, it meant to create a sense of dread about this whole thing that he's getting into with the cartel, like as if we needed more of that. Or if that's just simply like, did they stage this thing in an old converted abandoned office building?
That they wouldn't have left it there if it wasn't intentional, because it's so nasty. Surely to God, somebody in the room would have said, hey, what's that? Can like, we make that like not be?
Maybe the judge should be saying that. This is a New Mexico courtroom. This is an official place of law. Like, they should not.
Yeah, just switch those out with like House the ones in the bathroom or something. Just switch the tiles
yeah.
out. Yeah. It's the staining of his soul. Has he?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
You're not wrong. Okay. So I have questions because obviously Lalo by the end of this can pay his bail, pay his bond, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The $7 million isn't going to be too much of a problem as long as Saul can get it for him. Do you think this series will end with Lalo in jail or dead? Because like he's in this war with Gus, he's gonna be a fugitive. Like they make it clear that he's getting out on bail so he can never return, right? So he can just live the life of a fugitive and I assume stay in America doing so. Do you think that he gets caught and taken to jail and that's how he's out of the picture in Breaking Bad, or is it more like Gus is gonna kill him?
There are a couple of things in this episode, and I will get to them, I guess, that make me think that he is going to run back to Mexico.
Really?
And that he may be killed there.
Hmm. Is it the fact that he can run the operation from jail? So why couldn't he run it from Mexico? Is that...
That and also just a few storytelling things.
Hmm.
Like the story that Mike is reading to Kaylee.
The Little Prince?
Mm-hmm. The part that he's reading.
Hmm. Okay. I guess we'll talk about that when we get there.
I was going to say, do you want me to talk about it now? I
can do that. I'm curious.
Scroll through my notes on my phone because I'm a professional. The last line that he says the second to last is my flower in danger of speedy disappearance? It certainly is.
Mm-hmm.
The whole passage that he's reading is about running, basically.
Okay.
And also the prosecuting attorneys make a point of saying that Lalo is a huge flight risk.
Yeah. Which, I mean, he certainly would be. It doesn't... I'm trying to think how I feel about Lalo.
He would have to be... He would have to know that he was fucked before he would run.
I think so, yeah.
So, and I know, apparently, whispers have said that the next episode is going to be... It's going to have a lot of the defining moments of this season in it, okay. Apparently.
Interesting.
So I'm curious to see what changes with Lalo's sense of his safety.
Yeah, especially because I don't think he feels like it's too urgent right now. Like, mm-mm. Look at him in the courtroom.
He's
reacting.
Totally chill, yeah.
He is so chill.
He's full Lalo.
If you look at that in contrast to Gus, who is kind of freaking out, like...
Mm-hmm. He's
not
the only one.
You don't ever see Gus crack. And when Gus does crack, you know something is really, really wrong.
Yeah.
And in this episode, Gus is cracking, right? Like, he's doing all the right things. He's still, like, keeping a level head, but he's showing, like, his anger, you know, in the way that Gus does, which, like, is just a grimace or something.
His shoulders get tight.
Right. He gives a look as his restaurant burns. But, like... Yeah. So far, I think the person winning this battle is Lalo. And Lalo is certainly less emotionally affected by it than Gus is. So yeah, I don't think Lalo sees this as a problem yet.
No,
he might eventually, though, like Gus, when Gus goes hard enough at him.
I'm mad curious what is going to happen in the next couple of episodes.
Because Gus is absolutely playing the long game here.
Yeah, he always is. That's his thing.
And that'll be why he wins.
Mm-hmm. Because Lalo is very much, I mean, he just sets places on fire.
And then he gets caught, and yeah, he has a way to kind of get out of it.
But only because he had a way to get into jail.
Right. Gus never lets himself get in those situations in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Rich and Kim apologize to Kevin for the situation with Saul and Acker and promise that it will never happen again. Kevin says he expected more from the firm and that personally, Kim could do a whole lot better than Jimmy and Saul. Before leaving the building, Kim decides they need to do something more. So they go back in to Kevin's office and Kim tells him he can't continue to ignore their very good advice and they're going to fire him as a client if he does. Kevin says, all right, see you on Thursday.
How many times is Kim going to have to say this will never happen again before the end of the series?
Jimmy around a lot.
Yeah.
A lot. But if it results in scenes like this, Kim, so I really love to see Kim breathing fire. The heat was not very intense in this scene. Like, Howard got it much, much worse.
Mm-hmm.
But these are her best moments. Like, every time Kim gets self-righteous on somebody, it's always enjoyable.
It's delightful. I wonder if she would have come back into the room if he hadn't had to get in that last little dig about Jimmy.
Yeah.
And then maybe she realized that she can do better than Kevin, too, as a client.
Yeah.
He's been a pretty shitty client, all things considered.
Yeah. He sucked as a boss. People push back on it. And I understand why people push back on it.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, the boss doesn't always have to have all of the ideas, especially when he has a talented team of people he pays.
But hey, if you have a talented team of people that you pay, maybe you should listen to them.
Maybe you should.
Maybe that's why you pay them?
Yeah.
It's to advise you?
No,
shocking.
Kevin's impulsive, too.
He is.
He wants what
head.
He wants. And,
yeah.
And no matter the risk, no matter the danger... no matter the cost, he's going to get what he wants. The other thing I noticed about this scene, and I don't think Paige is this type of person, but Paige is seated in this scene like they're about to do a mob hit on Kim and Rich. Like, she's right behind them, kind of off to the side, like she's going to pull a gun out at any moment and just put two in the back of their heads.
Oh, I didn't get that at all. My sense was she was putting herself on their side.
Yes, I noticed that too.
But also, I could totally see that. Her face when Kim is delivering her fucking savage burns to Kevin in this scene, she's like, damn. She's loving it. And I love to see her love it.
Yeah, Paige is a weird character in these scenes because she's not driving anything. Kevin's making all the decisions. She's not even really chiming in most of the time.
I feel like Paige is us in a lot of these scenes sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, sort of like just watching the ball ping pong back and forth across the net, and just sort of seeing where it ends up. And you notice at the end of the scene where she moves from being on their side, physically moves from being on their side of the room to Kevin's side of the room in the first half of this scene before they come back. It says a lot about Paige. Paige is sort of like, she seems a little like where the wind blows.
That's what I was going to say. She's cunning.
That's where she'll end up.
She has way more cunning than Kevin does. It's probably why that partnership works.
Yeah, and she's definitely like playing... she's definitely the subservient one in that... I don't know if she's a partner in that company or what.
Yeah, I said partner. I didn't mean legally. I just meant you always see Kevin and Paige together.
Yeah, I mean, I was about to say partner, but I really don't know what the relationship is quite...
I don't either. I feel like I should know that. Yeah. Oops. Oh, well.
Someone will write in and tell us.
I'm sure someone will correct our terrible mistakes.
Oh, yeah. All right. Saul tries to get Lalo to cut a deal, but Lalo says he's gonna get him out on bail instead. And he tells Saul to change his motto to just make money, to become a friend of the cartel. Do you want to be a friend of the cartel?
So here's the thing. I don't want to be, but also if I'm in a position where they'll just like kill me if I'm not.
Yeah.
That's hard.
I don't want to be an enemy of the cartel.
Yeah.
But I don't want to be a friend of the cartel.
I don't want to be a friend either. I want to be nobody to the cartel.
Yeah. Don't let the cartel know who I am.
Exactly. I don't want them to know my name at all.
Nope.
That would be good. I like how Saul immediately asks him about the strength of his pseudonym, his alias.
Yeah.
Right after he asks him about JMM. Like, wow, you could be a little bit more subtle. I'm sure.
Yeah,
he knows.
So maybe Lalo is more subtle and, you know, has a better story for his false identity.
Oh, I just meant that maybe Jimmy should not ask about aliases right after someone basically asks about his without doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a ton of confidence that the Salamancas set up an ironclad lie about his identity.
Mm-hmm.
I think there might be some holes, but guess we'll see. And it probably doesn't matter, honestly.
Yeah, I don't think it matters.
Although, I don't know. They don't bring that up for no reason, right?
I don't. So what I don't want is for... Or do I not want it? I don't know. I'm still kind of sorting out my feelings about that. What I don't want is for Jorge de Guzman to know who Jimmy McGill is. To know that Saul is Jimmy McGill. That seems bad for him down the line. But also, how could he hide that? Because he's been so flamboyant
and the cartel has a way of finding things out when they want to.
I'm always trying to tie back to Gene, like, how is this
because
I feel like somebody figured out who Gene used to be, or somebody traced down Jimmy to his Gene alias. So I'm always trying to connect the dots there, maybe incorrectly.
I mean, in that case, shame on the vacuum cleaner repair guy. The disappearer.
Sent him to Omaha, Nebraska, specifically Nebraska, which his ex-wife is also from. So that alone is kind of shitty on his part.
Yeah, we might talk about that in the feedback a little bit. Let's move on to Mike reading a bedtime story to Kaylee, and afterward talking to Stacy about their respective kids. And Mike tells her that he's better now, after deciding to play the cards he was dealt. Is Mike talking about the cartel cards or the Maddie cards or both? It seems like there are some parallels here with Mike and Saul sort of giving themselves over to the criminal underworld.
Yeah, I think he's just given up.
Yeah.
He's given up trying to fight the positions that he's found himself in. And he's found some perverted version of peace in that.
Yeah, and I'm always looking for the secondary meaning in scenes because, you know, Saul, Better Call Saul is a show that has a lot of those.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, in this moment, like, he's telling Stacy, look, I'm better now. I'm coming to terms with the Maddie stuff. Here, let's talk about it. I can do that without getting so emotionally overcome that I shout at you. But also, I think, yeah, he's talking about his position with the cartel and with Gus and just saying, like, okay, this is who I am now. I'll probably try and control that and keep it out of your lives, but I'm going down this road.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll still try to do it kind of ethically, but how much does ethics actually play into things whenever you're working for the cartel? Probably not much.
And how much is Nacho's situation going to complicate things for him? I mean, we know that's the thing about a prequel. We know it can't complicate it so much that Mike gets killed or Mike gets out of Gus's good graces, like we talked about last week. So there's a finite set of probabilities here about how this turns out.
Yeah, you know what's going to happen, but you don't necessarily know how it happens.
And that's important, yeah.
That's what this whole prequel series is based on.
Mm-hmm. Anything else about maybe the book he's reading, or?
I already said it, but okay. Yeah, he mentions.
No other insights into the Little Prince?
I don't know shit about the Little Prince.
I didn't even bother looking it up.
Sorry.
It's a kid's book. I can't imagine they're making like deep philosophical points with the Little Prince.
You are so dismissive of kid lit.
The Little Prince.
And YA fiction. Good.
Call me when the prince grows up. Call me when we get
the
big king.
Big king.
And then we'll talk.
Isn't that what BK stands for?
vicious war going on between BK and Magical Electromotive right now.
Oh no.
You think Avocado Mania was a hit? Wait until you get Flame Broiled Mania.
Shout about Avocado Mania. Oh,
we will.
My God.
We'll talk about it. All right, Jimmy and Kim get home and begin getting frisky.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy interrupts the moment to tell Kim about his predicament with Lalo and how the money is attractive to him. Kim questions whether it's worth getting mixed up with the cartel. According to Jimmy, it's not a problem because there's no judge in the world who would grant Lalo bail, which I knew immediately right then and there that it's the most dramatic outcome of this thing, that he would get granted bail. Kim thanks Jimmy for telling her about it, and they get back to business. This is where I really start to worry for Kim, because she knows, you can see it on her face, she knows this is an extremely dangerous thing, not just for him, but for his family, which she is now a part of, and you see what's happening with Nacho and his dad right now.
Mm-hmm.
This is not going to go well.
If you started this season, or the season before it, or the season before that, thinking that things were going to go well for any of the people in this story.
Yeah.
You're a fool.
No, I mean, we know where it ends up.
I have one major problem with this scene. Well, two major problems. One, just awkward on-screen chemistry always between these people.
Yeah.
I think so, a little bit sometimes. It was better. It was better here. I saw one person on Reddit say this is the first time they watched the show with their mom, so of course it was the first sex scene in Better Call Saul.
Uh-huh.
Perfect. One. And two, Kim is wearing a strapless bra to work. No fucking way, man. No way. Those things are so uncomfortable. They're binding and they slide all the time, so you're constantly adjusting them. She would never wear something that she has to constantly adjust all day.
If she's wearing
three layers of clothes,
a shirt that covers her shoulders, why would you bother wearing a strapless bra?
Exactly.
Strapless bras are for blouses that don't have sleeves and shoulders, right?
Yes, exactly. And dresses. It's just for that shot.
Essentially, just
her.
For wearing tube tops. That's the only thing that's strapless and low cut dresses.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
sorry, I interrupted.
You've made the same point in a different way, interrupting me to do it.
Wait, so it's for clothes that do not cover the upper port? Okay. What was your point? I'm sorry.
My point was them shits are uncomfortable. I do not believe that she would own more than one of these. And two, that she would be wearing it under all those layers of clothes. Because again, you're constantly having to adjust them because they slip and they're just fucking awful. They only did it to get that shot of her with, you know, the half sunset on her face so that they could have her shoulder lines unbroken by bra straps. Bullshit. What? Sexist.
But this is her wedding day. She's all gussied up.
She was wearing a sleeved blouse under a sleeved jacket. Also, she was wearing just like normal lawyer panties. She wasn't wearing lacy nothings.
What? She doesn't need to. She's got the fancy bra on.
Ugh, so disgusted. That was the thing I wanted to yell about in this scene. Let's move on.
Okay, yeah, let's do it. Lalo's given a phone in his jail cell and continues running the cartel operations from there. He's got a job for the person on the phone. Spoiler, that person is Nacho.
His
and that
bedroom?
Job is destroying Gus's chicken house.
I've called it a chicken shack in my notes every time because I forget the words. I'm sorry, I'm dumb. Who could be better than Ocho Loco?
That was my question. There is no one with a better name, certainly.
Certainly. No one with a more recognizable name currently other than Nacho himself.
Yeah, or Jorge de Guzman.
The chip boy.
Yeah, no, I was surprised to hear that there was someone better than Ocho Loco.
I also enjoyed him shooing away his cellmate. Mm-hmm. That was just a nice little touch.
Yep. He still seems completely unfazed, even though he's in a cage.
This is not the first time he's been in a cage.
Of course, yeah.
His hand was at the ready for that phone sliding under the door. He just, got it. Perfect.
Next up, Nacho tells Mike that he wants out, which we already knew. Of course, he can't go to the cops and wants Mike to help him. And Lalo has put Nacho back in charge and wants him to burn down Los Pollos Hermanos. Mike is, you know, flabbergasted by this whole thing, drives off with intention, though. He's, he's going to go back and report to Gus, obviously.
Mm-hmm. He's on the phone as he drives away.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, he starts pulling out his phone, I think. Mm-hmm.
I don't have a ton to say about this. We've kind of already talked about the danger that Nacho is in, and this is sort of a follow-on to that stuff, potentially positioning us for something more interesting where Nacho either has to take it into his own hands or figure out some way, like actually make a move here. And I don't know if he's been working on this in the background, if he's got a plan and maybe he's sort of pretending to be a little more freaked out by the whole situation than he currently is or what, but I don't know. We'll see.
He's definitely feeling the pressure, and he is in the middle of multiple conspiracies at this point. It's a rough place to be in, but also that's the most volatile place to be in. If he really wanted to fuck stuff up, he could ruin things for multiple groups of people at this point.
Sure could, and for Mike as well. But we know that doesn't happen. All right. Gus is in a Madrigal meeting where he introduces Los Pollos Hermanos' new Spice Curls.
Spice Curls.
The curly fry with the Southwestern kick. Afterward, he's taken to his accommodations for the evening where he gets comfortable and then goes to Peter's attached room where Lydia also is. And Peter asks if they can continue construction on the super lab. Gus says no because Lalo's still in play. And Lydia suggests murdering him in jail, but that would start a war. Peter is super worried about the tax auditors figuring out that they've been building this thing and he's involved in these drug ops. And Gus gives him a pep talk to cheer him up. It seems to work. So much stuff in there. Should we talk about the meeting first? The Madrigal meeting?
Yeah, I need to yell about Avocado for a second, if you will permit me.
Do it.
I cannot accurately express the depth of my horror at the idea of putting Avocado on a fish sandwich. What? Two mushy substances meeting? They should never meet. Never on bread. Never in life. What are you talking
like
about?
In a hot dog bun.
No! Are you talking about putting fish on a hot dog, sir?
No, not on a hot dog. The fish is the hot dog. And the avocado is the relish.
Why is that better?
It's not. Yes, you are 100% correct. I did not notice that they were talking about fish plus avocado, which makes me question what I was actually thinking, which is they started the millennial avocado craze way before it actually started. Like they're in 2004. I don't think that was really a thing back then.
No.
So they might have actually started it, but how would they start it with a fish and avocado sandwich?
You know what? I'm realizing now that that might not have been the fish lady. That might have been somebody before her talking about avocado mania.
Oh, well, I'm leaving that in the podcast because it's too good. Too delicious.
It can be on a burger. That's probably okay.
On a burger? Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe in a taco.
Like a salad burger. Like an avocado and then some leafy greens that are not just iceberg lettuce.
We would know it, as you said, as a millennial burger now.
Yeah.
Man, they really were ahead of the curve.
They were. So was...
I hate avocado.
Luftwaffle.
Luftwaffle.
Which... Luftwaffle, I guess, is how you would say that. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to feel about Luftwaffle. Here in America, that might fly. No pun intended. Because the Luftwaffe, which... Oh, I'm not German. I apologize to Mike Ehrmantraut. I apologize to Werner Ziegler.
Ziegler.
And all of their kin. Okay. So the Luftwaffe is the German Air Force, okay. And they have a role in World War II that is less than, we'll say is a bit tarnished.
Okay, is that where I know that word from?
Yes.
Because it seemed familiar to me. Oh, what? Nazi waffles?
Uh-huh.
Oh, that's uh-huh. That's unfortunate.
And Madrigal Electromotive is a German company.
Yeah.
So the... Maybe wow. I just don't know the proper history here. I don't have the right context for modern day Germany, but that seems like an offensive pun
that for your restaurant. Gross.
Unless
yeah.
unless they're exclusively operating in America, which is possible because I think Los Pollos is also just operating in America.
American. Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, that seemed strange to me. There's some other ones, but the Luftwaffe was definitely the best pun.
You know... But then also, the airline is called Lufthansa, so maybe Luft just means lift.
Maybe, but Luftwaffe definitely has like a connotation.
I'm right there with you. That's kind of fucked up.
They own at least 10 subsidiaries, which I think all we knew of in the past was just the Madrigal side of things, not like the... okay, so this Peter guy.
Yeah.
Let's talk about him because he is a character from Breaking Bad.
Season 5, episode 2.
If you remember from that season, he's the guy who tasted French.
He did taste French. Sorry.
French?
Ooh, no, it's French. It's French. Maybe it's French.
Depends on where you're from, probably.
Oof.
But yeah, so what I'm talking about is he is the guy who kills himself on the toilet in the episode, episode 2 of season 5, it's after Gus gets killed, and then the word kind of comes out about the drug operations that were running out of Gus's facilities.
I think in the scene leading up to that, it's in the same scene, there are investigators actually coming into Madrigal.
Right. And so he just, you know, kills himself.
With a defibrillator?
Yeah, that sounds right. I don't remember exactly how it happened, but I do seem to remember him grabbing that first aid kit and heading to the bathroom.
I'm pretty sure that's what happened. Dude is kind of... There's something about him in this scene. He seems like he didn't have a whole lot to start with as far as mental capacity goes, or at least as far as emotional capacity.
Yeah, he's overwhelmed in this scene, which is why Gus needs to give him that pep talk, because he's having financial auditor woes.
Mm-hmm. And Lydia is talking to him like he's a 90-year-old little
Jesus
grandpa
Christ,
or something.
Lydia.
She's so condescending.
Also,
look who's here. It's Gus.
I know. It's because Lydia is incapable of inspiring anyone.
She's awful.
I don't know how she got to the position she's in. But yeah, she's kind of the worst. I do like that she is always suggesting they kill someone in jail.
In jail,
This is kind of her go-to move. Don't they just kill people in jail all the time?
Like, Chankard, Chiv, you know, that that whole thing. Toothbrushes.
And I really like the moment after Gus delivers his speech to Peter, his pep talk, and Peter kind of snaps out of it, and Lydia lets her breath out. Like, she's been holding her breath this entire time that Gus was speaking, because this seems like a measure of last resort to have Gus come in and personally deal with Peter.
Mm-hmm.
She was totally incapable of calming him. And so, like, if this didn't work with Gus, she had nowhere to go with Peter. Yeah.
She just had to deal with him being a nervous fucking wreck.
Yeah.
And you can tell she's so relieved that she breaks out the champagne later. Prost.
And I think she was worried that he would do something rash. He would like make some himself. Bad decisions. Yeah. Yeah, exactly like that.
I can't imagine why she'd be afraid of that. And we hear about fucking Santiago again.
Yeah.
They're going to have to address that soon. They're going to address it soon.
They hint more around the edges. They say that, you know, it was the two of them. Their backs were against the wall. Gus will never forget what he did. What happened? I don't know.
I fell down a Wikipedia black hole early this morning. I did not realize that there were German settlers in Chile. That's a thing.
Hmm. Okay.
For one thing, the first engineer in the settlement outside of Santiago, after Santiago was conquered, basically, indigenous people were kicked out / murdered. Huh. So that the Spanish could conquer Chile.
Mm-hmm.
And the first engineer in the colony was a German.
Interesting.
And then in the mid-1800s, the law of selective immigration was enacted in Chile, basically saying, hey, Germans, come over here. Come settle the southern part of our country.
So it's just like a big expatriate community
kind of, but it's also, it's been, the history of these two people has been intertwined for a very long time, and I had no idea. So it makes total sense now that Gus would be working with so many Germans.
Interesting. It's okay. I didn't know that. Sheds a little light on the situation.
Sorry, we turned into stuff you should know for half a second there.
Yeah, I think it's cool.
Moving on.
All right, let's move on. Jimmy and Jim browse the farmland options that they're going to buy with the money from his new life. I think that's what he's doing. He's like teasing her with the properties they can buy with cartel money. This is too soon, Jimmy.
It is very too soon, but also very on brand for him.
Yeah.
That's absolutely what he's like jokingly saying. Oh, look at this. Flowers dancing in the breeze or something.
Yeah, dancing in the sunshine, waving in the breeze, the same thing.
Having fun no matter what.
So is this also possible that he's trying to gather data here to figure out where she might want to go for a honeymoon? I can see like an episode where they go off on a honeymoon.
Yeah.
And then in the middle of it, he gets like a call from the cartel or something.
I didn't even think about that. That's
a
fair point.
It totally disrupts their honeymoon and, you know, re-impresses upon Kim the life that this is going to lead to.
I thought he was just feeling her out.
Yeah, there was a mention from Huel of the honeymoon, and he didn't even seem to have considered it at that point. And then they're looking at this stuff, and I'm like, maybe.
That's a fair point.
So Mike, then Kim leaves for work, and then Saul gets a call from Mike. He pretends to be in a tunnel, but Mike shows up at his door and says that he needs Lalo out on bail and gives him everything he needs to make it happen.
Sock garters.
Yep.
I forgot those were a thing.
He
and this
loves
episode
them.
Reminded me that they are a thing.
Mm-hmm.
We got to see Bob Odenkirk in his skivvies, which is actually more decent than
did you enjoy the
episodes.
Show? Like Mike did?
Sure. His upper torso is more built than I expected it to be. That's not from this scene. It's from the first scene. But
Bob Odenkirk? Yeah, he's in good shape. Especially for a man his age. Jesus.
Yeah, absolutely. I was expecting flab, and I got fab.
And you got flabbergasted.
That's better than what I said. God damn you. Go say the other stuff you're going to say.
I'm going to say that Jimmy's in a really, really tough place here. When Mike comes in and gives him, you got to remember who everybody's working for here. It's really fucking dangerous because Mike is coming in from Gus's side of the equation, telling him to betray his bosses, who are Lalo and the Salamancas and Nacho. Nacho is telling Mike that he wants Mike to betray his boss to help his father out. Lalo, I don't know. I mean, we all know where Lalo stands. He's on the Salamanca side, but like he's got Saul in his grasp, and anywhere that Saul tries to move out of the box he's in is extraordinarily dangerous. Even moving within the box he's in, like What's he going to do? Tell Mike no?
He can't. Like, he literally can't.
And it's also the fact that, like, Gus is giving him the pieces he needs to do the thing that Lala wants him to do. Mm-hmm. Like, that's clearly the obvious choice here, but it puts him in deeper with everybody.
It does.
And you can't serve two masters in the cartel. It's just not possible.
I love so much that they use the same evidence that they used to get Lalo into prison to get him out of prison.
Yeah.
That is a beautiful turnaround. I was like grabbing my head when I realized that's what was happening in this episode. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, brilliant. How could you?
It is extremely brilliant. I also like the moment where Saul asks Mike if he knows what Lalo did when he's like telling him, okay, you got to get him off on bail here. Because it's clear as we get deeper into this episode that Saul is not feeling good about what he's doing here. I mean, especially when he's confronted with the family of whoever died at the travel wire. I don't know his name. I'm like Lalo, I guess.
Oh, Fred. It's Fred.
Fred?
It's Fred.
It's a bad name.
It's kind of a bad name. It's a Flintstones name.
So yeah, he's feeling guilty about it. And that question, like, do you know what Lalo did? Did you hear about it? Like, you really want me to help him? It just indicates that he's kind of disgusted by his own actions.
He is. And like you said, we see that in a much more real out-of-body way later. I just want to say Freddy is different than Fred. Freddy's cool. Fred's a weird name.
Oh, okay. the Freddy of Bald New Fame.
Covering my buns.
I would never call you Fred, Freddy.
I didn't realize that Fred Whalen is the name of the person. He looks... I'm a ding-dong because they showed, whenever Mike was giving him the evidence, all the paperwork, mm-hmm. they showed Fred Whalen's ID.
Yeah.
And at just a glance, I think it's the terrible mustache, but he's almost like a whitewashed Lalo. So I thought for a second they were going to try to frame somebody else and then, you know.
Oh my God, yeah, get a lookalike and say, it wasn't me, it was like the one-armed man.
This whole theory, and then I realized I wasn't just a dumbass, actually.
Nice.
So there's the journey I went on.
All right, let's go on a journey to the next scene. Nacho and Gus break into Los Pollos Hermanos, trash the place, and blow it up. Okay, number one question.
Rube Goldberg, go on.
Number one question, unless you wanted to elaborate on Rube Goldberg. Explain who Rube Goldberg is and his connection to Chile.
Thank you very much.
And colonialization.
Oh, we could go there. You're teasing me. Okay, let's go.
So number one question I had coming out of this scene is, how the hell does this turkey in the fryer blow the restaurant up? Have you seen any videos on YouTube about people who try to fry frozen turkeys?
Yes, it's a terrible idea. Thaw your birds, people.
Thaw your
because
birds.
The oil literally explodes out of the thing.
So yeah, what happens is you have the extraordinarily hot oil, which mm-hmm. has a higher boiling point than water does. Mm-hmm. And so when that really cold turkey covered in ice and full of juice, frozen juice, hits the oil, all of that water just instantly like flash boils. Mm-hmm. And it causes a whole bunch of steam to rise up out of the oil, pushing the oil up out of the pot as well. And that, you know, rolls over the edges and then hits the ignition source, which is like whatever flame or whatever yep. you've got that's heating up the oil. And it causes a spectacular fireball. Like mm-hmm. even just like a 5-gallon turkey fryer will cause a flame, I don't know, 15 feet high to shoot up. Like, do that in your garage and your garage is gone. Your house is gone.
Right.
And it's gone before you can even think about a fire extinguisher.
There were so many news reports of that. It was like 5 or 10 years ago when frying your Thanksgiving turkey was a thing, mm-hmm. like a big thing, or just becoming
That's
a thing,
That's why they always say to do it outside.
Yeah, do it outside and thaw your bird.
Yeah.
Thaw your bird.
Absolutely. So I was wondering, there's got to be, I would have thought there was some protections, some security features on a professional fryer that wouldn't allow any grease spills to come in contact with the ignition source.
Yeah.
Because the problem would be solved if that were the case. You wouldn't have to worry about it, but like that restaurant goes up, so.
It really does. you could explain it away by saying, oh, there were strategically placed oil barrels throughout the restaurant, and there was oil on the floor.
Well, I mean, the guest turns the gas on.
Yeah, it turns the gas on. But I could see that. I could see that exploding in the kitchen, perhaps, but not the entire restaurant.
No,
it's a little shaky to me. Also, it was a chicken, not a turkey.
Oh, I want to hear about it. I was thinking a turkey
and also
frying.
He
yes,
had,
you're right.
I thought that none of their chicken was ever frozen, but apparently that's wrong.
Oh, shit.
But also, this was the only chicken in the freezer. Did he just have a backup chicken? He has always had this plan that if he needs to torch this restaurant, he can do it in a heartbeat.
His ignition chicken.
It's his ignition chicken.
A chicken wick? It's a chicken wick.
His chicken wick.
I don't want to think about Gus's chicken wick.
He lit his chicken wick. He gently stroked his chicken wick.
Right, Bane. So this is a perverted Bane voice you're doing here. I don't like it.
Chicken wick. I'll lean even more into it now that you've, you made a mistake.
Right. Shh. I gotta talk about Gus and how
pissed, we have been talking about Gus
and how pissed he is to have blown up his own place just to keep Nacho's cover. Like that's
of
the thing.
He's mad.
Paying such a huge price here. He loves this chicken place.
Yeah.
What is Lyle gonna do? Lyle's gonna make half of what he was making on unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
Lyle's fucked.
It'll be less than half. Actually, it's usually around 40 to 45%. So.
Yeah.
It's bullshit.
Lyle's
screwed. Lyle is fucked. Everyone working behind the counter is fucked.
Mm-hmm. And he promised that he had dealt with this and he would not let anything happen to his employees. Got them all together and gave him a big rousing speech and made an apology. Now here he is, blowing up their workplace.
Just blowing up the joint. You know what? I saw him look at that fryer basket again before.
Right.
He set up
like
the chicken.
Inspecting Lyle's work or something.
It was Lyle's fault. If he had cleaned that fryer a little better. Mm-hmm. In that episode, he wouldn't have had to blow the place up.
The respect that Gus had for him would have overrode his desire to keep Nacho as a mole.
His conscience would have gotten to him. Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But I love the look that Gus gives, both as he's walking away, but also in his car. And these, you know, cool guys don't look at explosions memes obviously apply here. But like, once he gets in his car, you can just see how pissed he is that, you know, in his Gus way. Like, mm-hmm. He just gives a small look, and then he goes back to being Gus, but you know something is up.
But this is like Gus sacrificing a knight, basically, to win the game later down the road.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because like Gus, I think, correctly assumes that if anything happens to Lalo while he's in prison or jail, the cartel will assume that Gus had some involvement.
Mm-hmm.
But Lalo from the other side of this is not assuming that if anything happens to Gus's operations, the cartel will assume he had some hand in it.
Yeah.
It shows, I think, there are a couple of things, like I mentioned earlier, that highlight the difference between Gus and Lalo. And one of those things is patience. Mm-hmm. One of those things, like, you know, keep willing to make the sacrifice to play this longer game is well within Gus's wheelhouse, whereas Lalo is sort of making moves that all make sense in the moment, but he's not considering what the future of this looks like. And if the cartel were to say, why did Gus's shop blow up? You know, our source of income is diminished. Who mm-hmm. could have had a hand in that? Well, I mean, Lalo is the first place you might look.
He is clearly a firebug.
Yeah.
So it's his MO. It's a good point. Looking at battles versus wars here.
Mm-hmm.
That's why Gus is he's a soldier. He knows that they can lose the battle as long as he wins the war later on.
I wonder what that has to do with Santiago.
Santiago. Fucking Santiago.
I hope we find out.
Me too.
All right. Saul tells the detectives that he's on to their secret private investigator.
The detectives. The prosecutors. Saul tells the prosecutors.
One of them, okay. So one of them is definitely a detective. Detective Roberts
is
in there.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yes, but they're not both, most likely. Then in court, he presents his case that their witness was manipulated by the private investigator for nefarious purposes. And the prosecution asks that they still recognize Lalo as a flight risk and don't grant him bail. Saul counters that Lalo has a wonderful family who are in the courtroom, and he has no reason to run. And after some deliberation, the judge grants Lalo a bond of $7 million. And Lalo says, I can do that. But he's going to arrange for Saul to pick up the cash.
Could have at least chosen children that weren't blonde, I think, but that's my only complaint. That dark hair, as soon as the dark hair comes into your bloodline, it's just dark hair from there on.
It does tend to dominate, but also, like, this family, this doesn't really look like his family. They're all, like, clean cut. Lala's got armband tattoos and a mustache that screams cartel. Like, there's, I don't buy that that family would be involved in any way with this man.
It's pretty weak. Yeah. But just strong enough to work, apparently.
Well, that's the thing. I wonder how deep this cover goes, this Jorge de Guzman. How deep does it go? Do they have this arrangement with this particular family that if anything comes up, yes, you are, in fact, like, the family of this guy. How long has that been in place? Has it been ever since he's come to America? A lot of questions I have around, like, how ironclad his identity really is.
It's a fair point. It might not matter. Maybe none of this actually matters if he takes off.
Right. The end of the season. I don't think it does matter because, like you said, he's going to just skip bail immediately. But also, the court, I think it's a risk on Saul's part to try and pitch this is his family.
Yeah.
Because all the court has to do is say, okay, well, let's hold off a second and check that.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't check out, Saul's in just as much trouble as Lalo is at this point. Yeah,
the case is twice as bad.
Just as much.
Just as
they list his crimes. Murder in the first, robbery, tampering with evidence.
Yeah, probably could have stopped a murder, honestly.
Yeah. And they did have to stop.
This is the same scene where we see that fucking moldy, awful ceiling patch.
Yeah.
Pretty sure it's a staining of the soul statement, but also I could not look away from it, just like you.
Yeah. As I was mesmerized by the disgusting nature of it.
I even have in my notes, there's a huge, super gross water stain on the ceiling tiles behind his head as he lays out his defense.
But it did not get in the way of me noticing his crisis of conscience here.
His out-of-body moment, yeah. He was sitting one moment and standing the next.
He looks over at the what are their names? Waylands?
The Waylands.
The Waylands.
Waylands.
Yeah.
Oh, damn.
And looks, you know, like he's making the worst decision of his life. Looks like he has his back in the corner and has nowhere to go.
And he kind of does. I mean, if he doesn't do his best for Lalo, he's probably going to pick up on that.
Absolutely.
And actually, I would say that Saul is not in prime form during this scene.
He doesn't really want to be. He wants to be just good enough to make Lalo think he's trying.
Right.
But not good enough to actually convince the judge to give him bail.
Mm-hmm.
But I think also going through his head is his new wife.
Right.
And the danger that he's putting her in as he's staring at this family, which he now has once again after, you know, someone murdered Chuck.
Yeah.
Maybe Chuck, but other people too. Maybe we should talk about that.
Oh my God. Yeah.
The scene after court where Howard once again finds Jimmy, asks him about the job offer. Howard has connected the dots on Saul's shenanigans and the job offer. And Saul tries to play it off, but Howard hits the nail on the head and it unleashes Jimmy's rage. He follows Howard down the hall, telling him how much smaller of a man and concept Howard is. And it doesn't seem to make Jimmy feel any better.
Howard should never have gotten involved with these brothers.
Oh God.
Holy shit. This whole tirade of Jimmy's is so Chuck.
Mm-hmm.
It's chicanery all over again.
Yeah. Yeah, they both have a hot streak to them, sure.
They do, especially when the lies that they tell themselves about themselves are confronted.
Yes, especially then.
Yep.
Neither of these people want to admit their own faults. And I think Howard is right. So I've always been on the side of Howard is getting healthier.
Mm-hmm.
Howard is getting better, genuinely better. And Jimmy is repressing his feelings about Chuck. And here he, in my opinion, misplaces the blame. And he puts it all on Howard.
Tells him that he killed Chuck, yeah.
Right. But in my opinion, that is him not being able to come to terms with the role he had in Chuck's death.
He is hard projecting, absolutely.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. It's sad. He in this scene, he has to tell himself that Howard is a small man and that he's doing something huge and amazing and his potential is off the charts because he's a sad, broken man doing very bad things for very bad people and to perfectly decent people. Like, It's despicable. Like, everybody talks about Walter White and wonders, where is the moment? When did you get off the Walter White train mm-hmm. and realize that he was just an irredeemable person? There have been a few moments like that with Jimmy, and I think this is one of those. This is the one where he knows, like, it's all about, like, the knowledge of what he's doing being wrong.
Right.
In my opinion, that changes you from, like, a bad person to from someone who does bad things but doesn't actually, like, totally get that they're doing bad things, to someone who knows they're doing bad and does it anyway. And that is the far more reprehensible thing.
I would agree with that. This whole thing of his, it's so unhinged. I saw a couple of people comparing this to, like, Walter White's
poisoning Brock, or, you know.
No, his whole speech, I am the one who knocks, or whatever.
Oh,
this is not that.
No.
This is Jimmy losing his shit. This is Saul losing his shit and showing us that he is a little bit unhinged.
Yeah.
This streak of his runs deeper than he's been letting anybody see. He's completely in the wrong in this situation.
Oh, yeah.
And he knows it, too. It's just like Chuck. After he does this tirade, he realizes, oh, oops, that was very unprofessional, and tries to straighten his tie and just strut back through the hallway.
He realizes what it looked like to everybody who saw it.
Yeah, like he was a crazy person.
And he realizes that their image of that conversation was correct.
Yeah.
That their impression of it. And, yeah, I gotta say, like, we talk, you know, when Racy Horn unleashes fury upon Howard or Kevin or Rich or whoever, we always
Racy
applaud.
Horn. Sorry.
Hmm?
I thought you said Racy Horn. No,
Racy
nothing.
Horn?
Go on.
Ray Seahorn unleashes fury. We always talk about how amazing she is, and she is. She's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Odenkirk in this scene is also equally incredible. When Kim does it, Kim is a fundamentally more serious and impressive character, I think, than Saul Goodman. And so when she does it, you really root for her, and she kind of comes off as, like, yeah, she really stuck it to him.
Mm-hmm.
When Bob Odenkirk as Saul Goodman does it, there's a silly quality to the man, a pathetic quality to it.
Yeah.
That Bob is able to, like, to bring to this character that... It's equally impressive on an acting level, but it's also just a complete night and day difference between how I feel about these characters when they do essentially the same thing.
Jimmy always feels desperate. Saul always feels a little bit desperate.
Absolutely.
And you don't really get that from Kim.
Never.
She's usually, even if she is maybe pushing it a little far, like she did with Acker, mm-hmm. I think a little bit, you could still see where she's coming from. She's still... based her tirade on truth a little bit.
Yeah.
And Jimmy is all, it's all feelings and explosions.
I just love, like, Bob Odenkirk does such a good job with the physicality of this character too.
Yes,
like,
absolutely.
When you see him, like, when he's on.
When he's wheeling and dealing.
He's always, like,
he's moving around.
And, like, his arms are going, his mouth is going, his head's moving. In these scenes, he's doing a lot of the same things, but he's able to bring, like, an awkward feeling to it, like a not quite sure physical presence to it, where he's up on his toes. He's, like, trying to look bigger than he really is. He's the god of lightning shooting
but
out of his fingertips.
But this shit exactly is so insane and over the top that it crosses that line into ridiculousness.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I couldn't believe, also, for someone who is so good at lying, whenever Howard... basically says, hey, fucko, I know that you're the one who threw bowling balls at my car mm-hmm. and sent hookers to my work lunch, sex workers.
Uh-huh.
He's so bad at lying in that moment. I don't know if he was never expecting to get caught what it was.
I think so.
Yeah,
he's not used to getting called out by people.
Except he does get called out by people all the time, but he doesn't get called out by real people.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. He gets called out by people criminals. Who he's actively in the process of conning.
Yeah.
And Howard's not that. Howard approaches him. Howard's almost pulled, like, this weird magic trick on him where he's reversed the power dynamic here because mm-hmm. Jimmy, you know, he's doing all these horrible things to Howard. He thinks he's got the upper hand, but Howard it's like kind of like Lalo. Howard is unfazed by this stuff. You know, he doesn't like having his Lexus smashed by bowling balls.
But he approaches it very calmly.
Yeah, he's zen, for lack of a better word. And Jimmy doesn't know how to deal with that,
yeah.
I think. Like, people who aren't taken in by the things he's doing, he has a much harder time to deal with. And
you look at, like,
the cop who arrested him back when he was selling cell phones, that Huel hit with a bag of food.
Yeah.
That guy also had a similar effect on Saul.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Saul was trying to run his game, but the cop was just like, I see your game. I'm not playing it. Like, I'm just going to give you the warning. And then Saul didn't really know how to handle him.
Yeah. He knows how to handle anger and suspicion.
And suckers.
And suckers, yeah. People who, like, are
copy machine salesmen.
Yeah, so willing to believe a lie because it gives them something that they want.
Right.
But when confronted with genuine concern for him, yeah, which is what Howard was kind of showing, like, okay, I don't know how I upset you, but don't worry about it.
And that's the thing. Howard doesn't have anything he wants from Jimmy.
Yeah.
He wants to give Jimmy something, mm-hmm, and Jimmy doesn't know how to accept it because it would mean acknowledging his emotions, I think.
Ugh, this poor broken man. Jesus.
Yeah, he's fucked up. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. That's it for the episode. We're gonna do some feedback. We've got a couple of pieces here, five or six emails. First one is from Chris, who had some stuff to say about your comments last episode.
Go on.
Said I just had to write in about last week's show to say that I almost spit out my coffee when Alexis coined the term yeehaw aesthetic. It's now part of my Twitter bio.
I didn't coin that, but I'm so glad that you are giving me the credit for it.
You didn't coin that?
I did not.
You read that somewhere?
I'm a terrible millennial who is online far too much.
Yes. I bet you love avocado fish hot dogs.
Excuse you. No. It's over. The podcast is over. I'm going upstairs. No more.
We're moving on to Rich, not that Rich. For the final word on smoke detectors. This
Tell
is
going
to be it because we finally got to the core of the information that I really wanted, which is why smoke detectors have radioactive stuff in them.
Yes, please.
So they have a radioactive material and a sensor that detects the radiation coming off of that.
Mm-hmm.
And when the smoke gets in between those two things, breaks the flow of the radiation, the sensor stops detecting the radiation and alarm goes off.
God, does that have to be radiation?
You wouldn't think so because he mentions the example of like a supermarket checkout conveyor belt that stops when the beam of light gets interrupted, the invisible light.
Maybe.
You could do it with that. You don't need radioactive material in your house.
Maybe light takes more battery power than radiation.
Yeah. I guess it would.
That being
it
a
definitely
point.
Would.
Yeah.
Transmitting typically takes more power than receiving. So.
Thank you, Rich, for being more present on this episode than Rich was. Mm-hmm. He was basically a well-dressed accessory to Kim. Kim's right. Fury.
Well, let's move on to Christian. During your review of Wexler v. Goodman, you were wondering what the connection was between all the scenes on which Jimmy plays the song Smoke on the Water, going as far back as when Davis and Maine fired Jimmy in season 2. However, I believe the song was first featured on the season 1, episode 4 flashback that introduces Jimmy's best friend, Marco.
Mm.
Both Jimmy and Marco are seen humming the song. It was sort of their battle cry.
Yeah.
Keep up the great reviews. Yes, this is kind of one of his go-to songs. And I think everybody's got those, right? Like, I know as someone who plays guitar about as well as Jimmy plays guitar.
You play better than him. Go on.
I have some go-to songs that I both hum and play from time to time.
I cannot say that I do.
I mean, he probably grew up in the era of Smoke on the Water.
He did?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely. We saw their birth dates in this episode, 1968, and I couldn't actually see Jimmy's birth date because the Amazon thing where they show the people who are in each scene was covering it up, so I couldn't see it.
Which is cool. X-ray feature?
Yeah, is that what it's called?
Yeah, X-ray. I find the pause screens on many services very lacking.
Leave a bit to be desired.
Yeah, especially if there's no way to dismiss the black overlay that they put on these things to dim them.
It just covers up like a third of your screen.
And you can't see the details that you really want to see when you pause. Like, pausing isn't just to stop playback. Pausing is also to take in something on the frame. But
why don't these UI designers think more about podcasters? Come on.
You should think about everyone.
You should think about everyone, and podcasters are included.
Yes.
And everyone.
All right, Mike writes in. Not that Mike. I'm rewatching the opening scene of last week's episode, and I swore that Kim's mom's license plate read Nebraska. Is that where Gene is hiding out? Any chance we get some kind of Gene-Kim reunion in the post-Breaking Bad timeline? Maybe after Saul inevitably gets Kim disbarred, she goes home to Nebraska? So to explain her absence from Breaking Bad and could set a pretty compelling final showdown. Thoughts? Yeah, we've considered stuff like this before. I just wanted to bring it up because I don't think we talked about the plate being Nebraska.
Wait, yeah, we probably didn't.
I guess that might add more potential here for some kind of reunion somewhere down the line. But I'm not really expecting to see much of that. I really don't. I think Gene is more about the fate of Saul, not about like catching up on, you know, the old times or anything. I don't think he's going to have much of a happy ending, and that would almost be too... it might be bittersweet. It might be bittersweet to have, like, a reunion with Kim or something.
I know that they don't do anything in this show without reason. They made a point to show us that license plate.
Yeah.
It is Nebraska. That is absolutely where Gene is.
Yeah.
I think that there is probably some kind of connection. I don't want to go ahead and say that they are going to meet up. Old Kim and old Gene, but...
People were talking a lot about this when I think Kim was interviewing for a job back in like season 2 or something. It was a long time ago. And she said she was from Nebraska or like mentioned the Cornhuskers or some team, which indicated she was. So like this might just be a follow on to the already established backstory of Kim, where like you already know she's from Nebraska, so this isn't a big reveal, but I don't know. We'll see.
Fair.
And then we got Doug, our resident lawyer here, not on the payroll. So he's not our legal representative, but he is a legal representative for someone somewhere. And he has a few fine points about spousal privilege.
Lay it on me.
Which, if you're not familiar, is the concept they're sort of leaning on so that they don't have to testify against each other. He says it only prevents a spouse from being forced to testify against the other. However, it does not allow one spouse to stop the other from testifying against him or her. That means Kim cannot be forced to testify against Jimmy, but if she chooses to, Jimmy cannot invoke the privilege to stop her.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think could be
problematic for Jimmy.
Yeah, that could be a key point. Number two, if they divorce, the privilege ends. Mm-hmm. This is different from an attorney-client or doctor-patient privilege. If I'm your attorney and you fire me, I'm still forbidden from disclosing anything that you told me in confidence while I was your attorney. In contrast, Kim and Jimmy's marriage, when it ends, Kim could be compelled to reveal confidential communications that occurred during the marriage. Therefore, she would be a valuable witness to the authorities post-Breaking Bad who are looking to learn more about Walter White's fugitive lawyer. Yeah,
that's
if
a
she
really
survives
good
this, she could have been interrogated.
Yeah.
I don't know how much she would know at that point. Depends on what their relationship is.
Mm-hmm.
But could be a lot, could be nothing.
There are a lot of people speculating whether or not she was just kind of in the background in Breaking Bad as Saul's wife. I kind of hope that's not the case, just from a female perspective, because we have a word for that. It's called fridging, and I hate it.
Yeah, I think she would be fridged for an entire series.
Please, God, don't make it be that. That's gross.
Retroactively fridged. Ugh. It's retconning a fridge.
Great. Just sitting in the corner, sewing doilies or whatever women are allowed to do. Ugh. It's gone.
We got two more points here. And also, actually, I wanted to say that people have pointed out that Saul in Breaking Bad doesn't have a ring, which they kind of neatly put a bow on here with them saying,
no,
we don't need rings. This is just like a formality kind of thing.
Right.
Interesting.
The only ring he needs is a gross pinky ring to go with his gross cuticles.
Mm-hmm. He has gross cuticles?
Oh, yeah. So dry.
He works in a spa, for God's sake.
I know. How could his hands be so nasty? Sorry, Bob Odenkirk, but your hands are kind of dry. You need to use more lotion.
All right. Number three.
It's New Mexico.
On Doug's list of spousal privilege points, the communications have to be made in a way where there would be an expectation of privacy. So the conversation in the McGill-Wexler apartment is privileged, but if Jimmy is talking to Kim on a cell phone in a public space where he could be easily overheard, his half of the conversation would not be privileged.
So the part of his conversation that could be heard not on the phone would not be privileged.
Yeah, that's...
That makes sense.
I wonder what value that could be. It depends on how specific the things he's saying are.
Yeah.
Number four, fun fact, New Mexico abolished the spousal privilege in 2019. All right, then we're going to move on to our last email from Amber, and I wanted to kind of save this for the end because it's something that we haven't... I think we might have specifically addressed this, but I've seen a lot of people writing into us and talking about this on Reddit and other places, still wondering about this point. So I'm going to go over it one more time. Amber asks, says, what I noticed still hasn't been discussed, so I thought I would throw it out there. A couple episodes ago, when Hank and Gomez bust Fring's guys, there's a very intentional scene where they're counting the money that they were able to seize, and they deliberately say that they confiscated
$700,000. Mm-hmm.
And I'll just paraphrase the rest. That $700,000 number is the same number that Hank mentions that they took off the drug dealers in episode one of Breaking Bad during Walt's birthday party.
Right.
So a lot of people are wondering, like, is this placing, you know, Better Call Saul in the timeline of Breaking Bad now? Are they converged here? And I just want to make it clear, no, we are still like 4 years out from where Breaking Bad picks up.
I think we did speculate on that in a previous episode. Police investigations aren't super cut and dry always, especially whenever they are trying to go after a big organization. It often starts small and then it builds over the course of years. So maybe that could be the same bust that they're talking about, but it wouldn't be, it would be something that had happened 3 years ago, not yesterday.
Especially if, yeah, like you said, this is an ongoing thing. Like, I look at, I mean, any documentary, the most recent one that I've watched that's an investigative documentary is the McMillions thing, where, you know, their investigation, yeah, they collect information, they probably make some busts and some arrests and take in some, you know, drugs and money and stuff, but the investigation continues, right? That's just like the beginning stages of it. Right. And then they try and roll everybody up in this investigation. And I think only once the investigation is complete and your operations are, you know, winding down, do you go to the press and start saying,
and start talking about,
hey,
it.
We took $700,000 and
yeah,
all this stuff, which I don't know, that might imply that this is the biggest bust they make until that point,
just
which
thinking,
is sad.
That's actually kind of sad. Like, no, okay, yeah. Maybe that doesn't make a lot of sense.
A couple of three low-level dealers and
running down
stash of cash, which is 1/10 of what Lala's throwing at bail money, like,
mm-hmm.
The culvert.
Sorry.
Yeah, so I don't. It definitely doesn't place us anywhere near Breaking Bad yet.
No, we know from timelines that we've seen online, and also they have said multiple times. Actually, as of this episode, we know that we are in May of 2004, and that's not Breaking Bad yet.
How did I miss that?
I think it was on the paperwork or something.
Okay.
Or I saw it on a website and didn't double check the veracity of it. That's also possible.
Could be. But that's it. That's it for our podcast. I want to thank everybody for joining us this week. We're, of course, going to be back next week with more Better Call Saul. If you would like to send in emails, you can do so at bcs@baldmove.com. Like you said, next week might be a real banger.
Could be a real
next
banger.
Next week could be the culmination of everything we've been seeing for 5 seasons. Probably not. But it'll be exciting, and we'll be back here to cover it. And until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Alexis.